huge two-passenger Thunderbird to product planning. Nobody was too excited about this idea, except that they had been listening to the complaints about getting rid of the two-passenger bird, and I had come up with a solution, an idea of how we could solve that problem. We make a two-passenger bird out of the four-passenger bird, and the easy, obvious way of doing it is just cover up the back seat. Now it looks like a two-passenger car. And at that time, we've been looking for the name of the product planner. It was Will Scott. Will Scott was Iacocca's product planner at the time, and they were in the studio all the time. And I was able to talk with Will about some of these ideas, and I showed him renderings, and he accepted the idea as a feasible idea that we could spend some time on. And of course, we developed the thing, and I worked out a lot of the engineering and as well as the styling concepts of how to use it and how to lock it up and how to store it and get rid of it and so on. Like in effect, it was like a hard top Thunderbird, mm-hmm. where you remove the hard top and put the soft top on. And as all designers do, you work off other ideas, and they generate new ideas and new solutions to old or new ideas for old problems and so on. And I convinced Will Scott that we should go ahead with this, and I got Joe Orris's approval to spend the time and the money and effort to model.
Are you working for Orris?
I was working for Joe Orris
in the
Ford Thunderbird as manager of the Thunderbird studio.
Right.
And I remember we had a designer working for us, a fellow by the name of Marty Kallman.
K-A-L-L-M-A-N,
who was the most far out young guy that we had. He was educated as a musician, as a concert pianist, and was a incredibly creative guy that never made it as a car designer because nobody could understand him. And several times people had tried to get rid of him, and I said, no, let's keep this guy. He inspires everybody else. He's so weird, and he does such funny things that he's good for us. He really is a positive factor in this studio. Well, you could never put him on a project to get something done and on the car, but I always felt that he was such a great influence because of his wild ideas. He was an incredibly great illustrator. He was a fabulous illustrator and artist. And I got him to do the first illustration of this thing, and he put in Henry Ford and Iacocca and Will Scott and me and Joe in the background standing around this thing. And I have tried for years to find that rendering, and I could never find it. I don't know where that rendering is. I'd give anything to have that rendering. Number one, because Marty Kallman, that rendering was a beautiful rendering, a beautiful piece of work. He did a job for Walker that was put into the Metropolitan Detroit Airport. It's a huge mural of the Detroit Metropolitan Airport with a plane coming in for a landing, and it was outstanding. There are several huge paintings that Marty did around styling someplace, probably in the back in the storage area now. Sports cars going careening around mountains and busting through fences, and just tremendous guy. But that project got approved, you know, and they put it into production. They actually went into production with, I don't know how many of the damn things they sold, but it never really went over, except that I remember reading about some guy out in California had one, and he was trying to find out how it got started, and he was pretty happy with his tonneau cover. I don't know how many hundreds or thousands they built of those things.
They're still in demand.
Yeah, it was a unique experience.
Did you have any production problems with it?
I don't think so.
No?
I think we worked the thing out pretty well. It was...
You mentioned it was fiberglass.
It was a two-piece fiberglass, or folded. And it could be removed, or it could stay in there with the top up. That was the thing that we had worked out.
Uh-huh. Where would you store it if you removed it? Would you restore it in the trunk?
You could put it in the trunk or, you know, or put it in the garage.
Yeah.
But, or you could leave it right in the car. That was, that was my, one of the things that I really worked on to develop was the ability to put the top up without having to take that thing out. Which made it a little more practical. If you were out on the road and it started to rain, you didn't have to take the whole thing apart to protect yourself.
Did the soft top fold, or did it disappear into the...
Well, the soft top, there was a panel right behind the tonneau cover, the panel that lifted up.
Right.
And the soft top folded into that, and then
right
this came
the
down.
Right into the panel, out of sight.
Yeah.
And then you had what you had was a really sporty looking...
It was wild looking because you went from the back of the front seat, right, you had a couple of bulges where the headrests were,
right.
And then you went clean back to the rear end of the car with a real long line that gave it a pretty distinct look. I think it was just too expensive for what it accomplished.
Very sporty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are still sought after by collectors today.
I imagine, yeah, because there's a few of them.
It lasted about one model year?
I think so.
Yeah.
They offered it, and, you know, I'm kind of proud of it because it was unique. And in the design business, you get so many people involved in a car. You never, like Iacocca says, there's so many people that claim to be the father that you wouldn't want to meet the mother, you know. But let's see, after the Thunderbird studio, I'm not sure what I did after that. I don't know whether it was then that I went up with John into the product design department.
John A. John.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With
this is in the early 60s.
Yeah. Now, it was while I was up there, I had had a I'm trying to relate some of the things I was doing in styling. Mm-hmm. With some of the things I was doing on the outside that kind of influenced things that were happening. I had bought a piece of property up north, and I had designed a little cabin that I wanted my boys and I to build. I wanted to get a project together that we could work on so they could learn to use their hands. And I designed this little cabin, and I took my two youngest boys that were born in Detroit after we came back, mm-hmm. up there, and we built this little cabin.
Where was that?
Up near Alger, up between Standish and West Branch. It was, at that time, it was about an hour and a half from Detroit. Way up in here. You go up I-75, mm-hmm. you pass Bay City,
right.
Then you come to Pinconning, Standish, right. And there's an Alger cutoff. I don't know whether you're familiar with that.
Right.
Well, just directly east of Alger is the Rifle River. About 4 miles east of Alger, the Rifle River comes through there. And there was Wells Creek that emptied into the Rifle River. And some developer, the guy that developed Lake Columbia, developed an artificial lake up there.
Uh-huh.
And I bought some property up there and built this little cabin with the boys.
You still have that property?
Well, we built that one, and while we were building it, I bought another piece of property, a bigger piece, on the lake, mm-hmm. and designed another...
Lake Huron?
No, same lake.
What lake was that again?
Forest Lake.
Forest
Lake? It's a little lake. It's a small, mm-hmm. man-made lake.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were building it, Bill was 14 and Kurt was 12. 12 years old, 11 or 12. And I taught Bill how to drive, and I said, now if anything happens to me, you got to be able to get me to a hospital. You know, we're up here isolated. And so I taught him how to drive, and then I showed him where the hospital was, and he took his driving pretty seriously and was a good, is a good driver. Mm-hmm. And those kids learned to use their hands. They learned to make mistakes and correct them. It was a great experience. Mm-hmm. And we finished that little cabin, and I said, now, I was paying them $3 an hour to work on it. And then I made them put $2 in the bank for their school, for their education, and they could spend the other buck any way they wanted to. Well, they worked up quite a reservoir of money, and they bought it. We bought a ski boat, with that money. Mm-hmm. And I designed another. While we were building that one, I designed a bigger place, and I asked them if they wanted to tackle that job, and they. I said, now, before you say yes, I don't want you to say yes and then leave me high and dry with it. It's going to be tougher. It's two stories, and it's bigger and more complicated. And I said, so think about it before you agree to it. And they agreed to it, and we started on it. Then I had a couple of physical problems at that time. I had an indication that I might have a problem with my kidneys, and in the process of checking that out, the doctors at the Ford Hospital collapsed my lung, and they really screwed things up, and that got straightened out. And then a couple years later, or a year later, I had a big heart attack. I had a major myocardial infarct. And that was really the end of my career in the design business.
Was this the mid-60s?
This was, I was 50.
I mean, 1960s.
Yeah, I was 54 years old. Well, that was in the 70s.
Oh, was
in the 70s. Okay. I was 54 when I had the heart attack, so that was 74. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's move you back into the 60s, where you're working after your success with the
Tonneau cover.
Where did you
work? Well, I'm trying to figure out whether. Oh, wait a minute. I went into the Mustang area, and I started the theme of the new big Mustang.
Okay.
When we, let's see, what year was that?
The original Mustang came out in 64.
Yeah, and then we had another series of Mustangs. And then I went in when they pushed the package way up. Mm-hmm. It got to be a big package, and when we got together and discussed this package, I said, hey, you know, this thing ain't no Mustang. This is a Thunderbird. I said, this is an ideal package for a new Thunderbird. Mm-hmm. The Thunderbird has gotten too big. I'd been working on the Thunderbird. Mm-hmm. And I said, this package is too big for a Mustang. It brings back, you know, people keep bitching about the fact that every time we get a successful car, we keep making it bigger and more luxurious. What we ought to do is take this package and make it a Thunderbird. Put a lot more quality and luxury into the thing and call it a Thunderbird. And if you recall that year, that what was that, the 70? '73 Mustang. It was about the time when we came out with that new big. And of course, I didn't get anywhere with that argument. And I set the theme for that car, and then I was moved out of there, and Gail Hollerman went in. Uh-huh. And finished up that Mustang. Uh-huh. And he gets credit for the design of that, or the blame for it, whatever.
Right.
I did it, but he gets the credit or the blame for it.
Did you, what was your situation when the Knudsen era began?
I can't remember.
Really?
I can't remember where the hell I was. Offhand, that was such a funny period because of Shinoda running around there. And
can you give us some impressions of how that happened?
It was just like a cartoon. It was so funny. It was so ridiculous.
Let's set the scene now. What had happened here in terms of...
Well, when Henry hired Knudsen...
Why did he hire him?
Well, I have to feel that Henry was so imbued with the power of General Motors, and with the potential when they passed over Knudsen at GM,
yes,
and with the potential of getting Knudsen into the Ford Motor Company, where Knudsen's father had
right. had really started
Henry,
right.
Henry number one. You know, it had been a factor in that era.
In enlarging their European situation.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think Henry was fascinated with that possibility and the prestige
uh-huh.
of having an Iacocca or
a Knudsen
in there. And
Iacocca was at this point ambitious and.
Iacocca was really running the place, you know.
Yeah.
And to have Knudsen brought in over him, I'm sure was one of the most devastating and hard to understand things that Iacocca ever had to face.
This was a sort of a Machiavellian decision on Henry II's part.
I think so.
Yeah. You wanted some way to impede Iacocca's progress?
Well, I don't know whether, I don't know that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that there was anything at that point negative about Iacocca
okay. yeah. right.
in the mind of Henry. I think that it was purely the plus factor of getting the Knudsen image into
right.
the Ford Motor Company
okay.
and,
yeah.
and feeling that Knudsen could add something to the Ford Motor Company.
Right,
and I think it was a logical assumption on Henry's part. You know, I don't think that he knew enough about
yeah.
why Knudsen was passed over, or you know. But I think that the image and the thinking on Henry's part, I think, was a fairly logical chain of events. You know, the guy.
It was a replay of the breach, bringing breach over in a way, was it not? The GM image, the well-known.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and this what I feel is that Henry had such a deep respect for the General Motors system
mm-hmm.
and the people that were running General Motors. This is the breach, having been a part of that, and a lot of the people that came from General Motors, and you had to have a lot of respect for the way GM operated and the caliber of people, the caliber of of their management and
mm-hmm.
the depth of their management,
right,
and the success of the company,
mm-hmm.
and I think this looked like a good opportunity for Henry. The thing that Henry overlooked, in my mind, was the strong ego of Iacocca, and the fact that you had good people at Ford. You had and the thing that was so bad and so devastating was the way Knudsen did it.
Mm-hmm.
He when he came in, he disregarded the people that were
yeah.
that had been carrying the ball at Ford. He disregarded Iacocca. You know, he completely ignored him. And then he brought a few people over from GM, including in our case the only. You know, the shining light was Shinoda, who we had fired once from Ford.
Really? I heard that. Where?
Oh, yeah. I think, as a matter of fact, I think Najjar is the one that fired him.
How many years before?
I can't remember.
Ten? Five?
five years before.
He had really worked for Ford and worked for
John. If I'm not mistaken, didn't John mention anything about Shinoda?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
It seemed to me that John was instrumental, his recommendation for getting rid of Shinoda. And Shinoda went to GM and got a job.
S-H-I-N-O-T-A. O-D-A. S-H-I-N-O-D-A.
O-D-A, yeah.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, then he comes back, and of course he ignores everybody in styling and he starts designing everything.
Well, this is an odd situation. Knudsen's coming in as president.
Right.
For him, and bringing his own personal designer with him.
Yeah. It was really strange, and he must have been very impressed with Shinoda, obviously.
Yeah.
Knudsen obviously was very impressed with him and the work that Shinoda had done on these Indianapolis sports cars and things like that. And Shinoda was a pretty flashy guy and very effective impression. He made a very strong impression.
First impression.
And I'm sure that if I'm right about John having been instrumental in getting rid of him, that it was because he couldn't work with anybody.
Right.
Because he never could.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And of course, when he came in, he ignored Bordenay and he ignored everybody in the place, and he was just screwing up. And I think Bordenay got the greatest pleasure in his life when Shinoda called him after he heard that Knudsen was out, and Gene said, "No, just relax, take it easy, enjoy yourself." Well, he was over in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And when Shinoda came back, there was nothing there.
Well, Knudsen had an idea that what Ford needed was a new sporty semi-racing image, did he not?
Well,
frankly,
I can't answer that question. I don't know what Knudsen. I don't think I was involved in anything with him. I don't think I was in the position to react to any kind of direct. I saw him an awful lot around, but I can't remember him ever being coherent enough for me to figure out what was going on. And this takes me back to another incident in the Ford Motor Company that absolutely astounded me. One time I got a letter from one of the product planning people, and I can't remember who it was. And it was right after we'd had a show, and I got a letter from Ford Division Product Planning, and it was directing me to do something. And I read the letter, and it sounded good. And then I said, now what? I didn't quite get it, so I went back and I read the letter again. And the more I read the letter, the less I understood what the guy was trying to tell me. And I started to worry about myself. And I spent about 3 hours on this thing, and I was really concerned about myself because the words were beautiful in this letter. Finally, I said to myself, I was working for Bordenay at the time, and I said, I hate to admit this to myself, but I've got to go to my boss, And I took the letter to Gene, and I said, Gene, I got this letter, and it's giving me some direction on one of the cars, and I can't remember what it was. I said, but I don't understand what he's saying. Would you mind giving me your opinion of this? And Gene is sharp, especially when it comes to stuff like that. And he read the letter and he started to laugh. He says, Bud, this goddamn letter doesn't say a thing. Turn that off. Yeah, this period of when I was moved into the advanced studios with Della Rosa. And Della Rosa, at the time, seemed to be quite distant from the operation, and so I felt quite a bit of freedom. And
can you describe the advanced studio? What its function was?
Well, we were charged with the responsibility of doing some unique things that weren't related to any kind of production cars.
Developing
the futuristic concepts, and specifically show cars.
Right.
At that time in the car business, we would spend considerable amount of effort and money preparing special show cars for the auto shows that were used to introduce the new models and
right.
and different shows in New York and California. And I was moved into that studio at that to do some of these advanced concepts, and had some very interesting designers. And and this is something else I don't want to gloss over too much is mm-hmm. are some of the people that are still there, you know, some of the younger designers and some older ones too, and some of the designers that never achieved big management positions but were very, very important people in the operation of the design center. You know, you can't help but feel that a lot of these people have been ignored. And I almost have the feeling that you're talking to the wrong people. You know, you're talking to the sort of the power movers, you know, with the Najars and the Bourdonnais and the Della Rosas and the big people, and the guys that were doing all the work are sort of being ignored on this thing. Maybe you're not ignoring them.
Can you elaborate on that? Can you name?
Well, I can name guys like, well, Tom Land is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Jones. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you've ever heard that name.
No. What was
Bob?
His,
well, Bob was a manager, but he was never considered to be a real hot designer. But he was really a valuable person for putting things together and getting designs put together and out, you know, out of the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Faniff is maybe you've heard that name.
Oh yes, go ahead and talk to
Still Charlie is one of the fabulous contributors to the design center.
Mm-hmm.
And a fine man, you know. These people are, you know, really, these are the guys of the design center.
Who else?
Faniff
was. Spell that for me.
Well, Faniff is P H A N E U F. Another great. Great guy that a lot of people thought was a pure showman was Homer Lagasse.
Ah, tell me about Homer.
Fantastic guy, and he's the kind of a guy that the people like Joe Orris mm-hmm. couldn't tolerate, because he was, you know, Homer Lagasse is a fantastic talker. He's a showman, and he's a. Do you know Homer?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You do, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think that
that's capital L A
G A S S E Y.
Right.
Homer Lagasse. And I see him occasionally, you know, when I get up north, because they have a little resort up on Lake Huron, and his wife Eleanor runs it. Yeah. Well, he's a great guy. But Homer was accused by Joe of being a, well, how did he put it? He was accused of, oh, I wish I could think of the term that Joe used. Flim flam, a flim flam artist.
Okay, all right.
Sort of a con man, but Homer could give you a dissertation.
Okay.
On a subject,
a verbal
flim-flam man,
right.
And Joe didn't like that because he couldn't understand him. You know, he couldn't understand Homer, mm-hmm. even though Homer was a very competent designer, a very competent guy, and I think that he's demonstrated that with what he's done at the Center for Creative Studies.
Right.
And, a tremendous amount of experience, and I think Homer has contributed an awful lot to the design business and to cars and probably a lot more than some of the other people that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Mills. Jack Mills is a guy my age that never got off the board, never cared to get off the board, was a very competent designer, a very individualistic, very strongly individualistic guy that he didn't want to be a manager and the importance of the people that really do the work. We were, the people I'm sure that you've been talking to were there once. When we started off, we were all there. I think that what you've been picking up, you Dave, is you've been picking up the big managers and the power people I never got quite to that point, but I made my contribution, which I feel good about.
You were close.
I was close, right.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it was my personality or whatever happened, that I never quite made it to the top. Boy,
it was a conscious decision on your part, not me.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, and. But I think that when you put yourself back to in the position of where you were when you were designing cars, not controlling the design, but actually making a contribution with ideas, probably was the most fun.
Yes.
Probably the most fun period. And another thing that you have to consider or you have to think about is, are all of the guys that helped you do the work that you were doing, and I don't know whether you ignore them or whether we as people moving up in a corporation ignore these people or whether we place them in a relatively unimportant role, but I can't help but feel that these are the people that save the business.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that are doing the work and that are, I think I alluded to Joe Orris earlier of how I felt that I spent a lot of my time saving Joe from himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but feel that there were a lot of guys that were working for me that were saving me from myself too, and contributing an incredible amount of creativity to the getting the cars designed and produced.
What categories would these be?
Well, I think that you would refer to them mostly as board designers,
mm-hmm.
guys that were given assignments to design a front end or design maybe you were starting on a new theme, but let's have some ideas. And these are the guys that fed you. You know, these were the people that were keeping you alive. They were these were the people that were bringing in the new excitement, the new blood to the product that we were working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Maybe it's. When you start getting involved with your own career and worrying about whether you're going to be the next vice president or the next chief stylist,
mm-hmm.
that you stop thinking about designing and you have to rely on these people. You know, you're looking for great things, and these guys come up with it. And these guys come up with the great stuff.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that's on the road. You know the.
Uh-huh.
And it ain't coming from the Bourdonnais, and it ain't coming from the Della Roses,
mm-hmm.
is coming from the, you know, the Jack Mills and, or maybe some of the young kids that I can't remember now or can't think of. I like to think of, you know, some of the fellows that worked for me in the advanced studio, for example. I don't know whether you've heard of the name Sid Mead.
Yes. Tell me about Sid. Tell us about
Sid. Sid Mead worked for me in the in advanced studio. Of course, he was wild. He was one of those rare guys that had an incredible imagination. And I'll never forget that when Della Rosa told Sid Mead that he was going to be transferred to the Ford studio. He was to a production car studio where he would design the real world. And Sid didn't say a word. You know, he just, Don walked away after telling him this. I don't know whether it was Don that told him or whether it was I that told him that he was going to be transferred. But Sid very calmly gathered up all of his tools and all of his personal belongings, never said a word to anybody, gathered everything up and put it in a box and walked out. He didn't say, I'm not going to the Ford studio or I'm quitting or... He just got up and walked out.
Now, what happened there? What was the problem?
He didn't want to work in a production studio, and he especially didn't want to work for Joe Horace.
Oh, okay. He was an idea man.
Yeah, he was a...
Fabulous illustrator.
Oh, yeah, and a very, very creative guy. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting about Sid Mead, my young son, who just graduated from Art Center.
In Pasadena?
In Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
Met Sid Mead. And has sort of adopted Sid Mead as a hero, and Sid Mead has gotten my young son some work, stuff that Sid didn't want to do. He's gotten Kurt to work on, and Sid was at Kurt's wedding, and I ran into him a couple of times out there since Kurt's known him, but he's had a lot of influence on Kurt on this young kid of ours that just graduated 2 weeks ago Friday.
Right.
Of course, Keith Teeter is out there. Keith Teeter was another real contributor to the design effort at Ford. And
how do you spell that?
Keith Teeter, T-E-E-T-E-R. And he had some physical problems and left Ford. And went out to California, and he runs the industrial design program at Art Center.
Does he really?
And
is Strother McMinn part of that?
Strother was. Now I'm not sure he's still there. I don't think he's still there. Mm-hmm. I think he left. And another one that left Ford that went out to California was Steve Shearer. And Steve Shearer is teaching a little bit at Art Center.
S-C-H-E-R-E-R.
Right, S-C-H-E-R-E-R. And he was an outstanding designer in the industrial design department at Ford with John Najjar.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he has a very successful design business going on out in Los Angeles.
So there is this conflict between the creative artist and the type of designer you might have to become if you stay with a large company. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I have the feeling that what I'm trying to say is that the more successful you get, the more successful you become in a big corporation, the less it is that you do.
Mm.
That was fun to get, that yeah. got you into the business.
Yeah.
And I think that you really become less of a contributor to the total thing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have to have leaders.
Yeah.
And obviously, you have to have an organization to get things done. But I can't help but feel that there is an incredible amount of waste in money supporting management organizations,
administrative
organizations.
Yeah.
when I look at now, there are exceptions. Obviously, there are strong exceptions to to the kinds of people like Joe Orris, who never got involved in that kind of crap. Even Grissinger, who I didn't especially care for as a, as an administrator, was much more effective and positive, kind of a working boss, a guy that was constantly contributing, and contrast in my mind to a guy like De La Rosa, who was, you know, absolutely worthless to the total organization. But that I found myself enjoying my work in the advanced studio and doing these show cars and, yes. and thinking, trying to think of new kinds of products. And I did one car that was a pretty far out thing that I had been thinking about for years. I was thinking about a car that a guy would want to drive to work, like a two-door coupe. And a car that he could use with his family on weekends. And I thought, well, why not make a convertible station wagon? You know, where you can, where you had a station wagon on weekends and a two-door coupe to drive to work in. I built one.
What was it?
It was a convertible station wagon on a big Ford chassis. And George Barris put the car together, and we showed it in several auto shows. It was
given a name. Remember a code
name? No, I can't. We only showed it a couple of times. It was such a complicated thing that it, you know, it never...
A convertible station wagon. That's marvelous.
Yeah, the idea was great. Now, Keith Teeter, the guy that went out to Art Center, he was one of the guys that was a very positive contribution, made a positive contribution to that model before he left Ford and went out to Art Center.
What was his contribution?
Well, he worked with me
on
the total package and the styling of this thing, and we were doing sport cars, and I probably leaned more to trying to solve some functional problems in the design end of the business rather than doing sporty fun cars. I probably lean more to the practical, you know, how do you make a station wagon more exciting, or how do you make a family car more exciting or more desirable. And I suppose that probably a lot of that was because of my trade school background, being more, a little more practical, and my do-it-yourself architectural work, which was, you know, everything I designed I built, and it had to be pretty practical if I could build it. And I think that, you know, when I left the advanced studio, I think it was when John Najar got me to come up to the industrial design department. And they were doing some pretty interesting things there. I had some physical problems then. That was when I had an accident. The doctors were checking my kidneys and they punctured my lung accidentally. And then and the thing that they were checking me for, cancer in the kidney, wasn't there, obviously. And you know, I went on from there, and it wasn't more than a year later that I had a big heart attack. Now, you know, in the business, as long as I was, you're under a lot of stress. You don't think you're under stress when you're under stress. I never thought that I was under any kind of stress. I always figured I like this, you know, I like going through this stuff. After I had the heart attack, I asked my doctor, I said, why the hell did I have this heart attack? You know, I thought I was in pretty good shape. He said, but it was pure and simple stress. I said, what do you mean stress? He said, well, you know, you've got these shows every Friday, you know, for Henry Ford and Iacocca. What do you think you're under when you're trying to get those? I said, hell, I was having fun. He says, it ain't all fun.
Tremendous pressures.
Yeah. And I had that heart attack when I was up there with John in the industrial design department. I recovered from it, obviously. But I think that was the end of my enthusiasm in the design. I was out of cars with working with John, and I had some fun working with on some of those.
What sort of projects did you both work on?
Well, we worked on the aircraft, on the company aircraft projects. We
was that the 747 project?
727.
Or 727.
Yeah. Steve Shearer and some of the other guys had done the majority of the work on that. And then they got rid of that airplane. We got some smaller planes, and we did some interiors for those smaller jets.
Executive jets.
Yeah. And John had some ideas for doing some filming, and I came up with an idea that we didn't get too far with, of taking a 360-degree picture with a single lens,
mm-hmm.
With a movie camera, but we would aim the camera vertically into a cone, a mirror cone,
mm-hmm.
and take pictures at. And I screwed around with that and got the shop to build me a cone and
mm-hmm.
and went over to the village and took some pictures of with a 35 millimeter camera. I had a lot of fun working with that, and we tried to get a patent on that thing, and we discovered that some guy had used an idea very similar to it for taking pictures in wells. In excavations.
Oh, yeah.
He had used a system for taking a picture down through a hole
mm-hmm.
to see what the material was.
Mm-hmm.
And then about that time, the oil crunch came, and the car business started going to hell, and I got demoted in my pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
Along with several others.
Well, unfortunately for me, I was a year too young. Several of the guys, like Roy Brown and Bob Thomas and Duncan McRae, and God, there were several guys that were over 55 that were able to go out at their grades.
Mm, yeah.
I was just a year too young, and so they did away with our department, so they were able to demote me.
Uh-huh.
And I had to take a 10% pay cut along with it. That takes a lot of starch out of you. It's tough on your ego, and it's I'd been an executive designer for 15 years, and it's hard to accept that happening,
mm-hmm.
even though you can accept the logic of it, emotionally it's a tough one. And I was moved into Mueller's studio.
This is Al Mueller?
Al Mueller.
What was he at that time?
He was chief in charge of Lincoln Mercury, and I was put in there under Art Korfeld,
uh-huh.
who was an exec,
right.
and in charge of the Lincoln and the Mark. The Lincoln and the Mark and the Thunderbird,
mm-hmm.
and Korfeld had the Lincoln, the Mark, and the Thunderbird, and the Mercury and the big luxury Ford and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I was just coasting. I felt like they didn't need me,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want me,
mm-hmm.
and. I had felt bad about not being 55 years old when this big thing had happened. I figured, geez, it would have been great if I could have. I told Roy, I wish the hell I was older, so I could get out.
The first time you thought that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was a few months, and I really was coasting, and I wasn't contributing anything. And one day, well, the thing that precipitated that feeling was one day I was doing some trim design for a Mark IV. And one of the modelers came up to me and asked me, "Bud, what do you want to do with this belt molding?" And I told him what to do. And it couldn't have been more than 15 minutes that Art came in and he changed.
Art Querfeld
came in and changed something on that molding. He saw the modeler working on it, and he made a change on it. And it wasn't more than an hour later that Al Mueller came in, and he changed something. This is really an interesting, when I think about it, it's really interesting. Mueller made a change on that molding, and by God, it wasn't an hour or two later that Bordenay came in. And I looked, and I sat there at my desk looking at this going on, and I thought, my God, it takes four executives to do something that a modeler could do all by himself. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, this is the end. That's an interesting thing. I hadn't thought about that until just now. That series of events that where I think I really, you know, said, the hell with it.
It was a highlight on a fender?
It was a belt molding on a Mark IV, one of the Mark models that we were.
Mark IV,
I think.
Four, yeah, right now. This was about 76.
Well, yeah, it must have been a 78 model because it was in 75.
Okay.
It was in 1975 that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't too many months after that Art came to me and he said, "Bud, have you thought about retiring?" I said, "Shit, Art, I can't retire. I can't afford it."
Uh-huh.
He said, "Well, how about letting us run it out for you? I can see what, you know."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, you know, if I don't have to commit to it, you know, I got two kids in school. I can't afford to retire at 55.
Mm-hmm.
And because these other guys had all gotten these beautiful special retirements, and
packages.
He said, "Well, would you mind letting us run it?" Well, you know, I'd contributed a lot to the design, and they were treating me as good as they could.
Mm-hmm.
I was all through, but you know, they were being good to me. And
how'd it work out?
So I said, "Well, if I don't have to commit to it, fine, go ahead." You know, and I went home, talked to Marina. I said, "You know, what would it take for us to accept this thing?" And we figured out, you know, what we thought we could manage. And a couple of days later, Bordenay called me up to the office and said, "Here it is, Bud." And I said, "What does Marie get if I croak?"
You know,
and he said, "She gets half of that." I said, "Where do I sign this thing?" Oh, they were good.
They
were good to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, what fundamentally at this point soured you on the whole situation?
Well, I think that what happens is that when you feel that you are going, that you're moving,
mm-hmm.
that you're contributing, whether you're a designer, whether you're a manager, or if you feel like you're contributing something,
right.
You feel good and you don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe it was the heart attack that triggered not only my own attitude, but also my management's attitude toward me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may have said, "Hey, Bud's all through. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't, you know, you can't give a guy that's had a heart attack a responsible position."
Although you recovered nicely.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the fact, you know, the technical fact is there. It's like a pilot's license. Once you have a heart attack, you can't fly for 2 years after you've had a heart attack, and then if you want to fly, you have to apply for a waiver on your medical. And it takes you forever to get that goddamn waiver. And then when you get it, you have to take a physical every 6 months.
Ooh.
Well, now, is it worth it?
Right.
Is it worth it? You know, you're in a in a business that's dynamic and exciting, and pretty soon a lot of things happen that kill that. My own age, the heart attack, having a department out from under you and being demoted, you know, you say, that's it. And that was it as far as the styling was concerned. And the good thing about that was that they saw that I was unhappy, and they made it comfortable for me to leave. And I left, and after a couple of months of reacting to that inactivity, I started at the Ford Motor Company when I was 15 years old. And, you know, after 40 years of being active in a charging way, to be, you know, out of it, it takes time to get used to that. But it didn't take me too long, because I started painting and playing golf, you know, immediately. And of course, recovering from the heart attack, I'd had a little bit of feeling for the soft life, you know,
right,
the good life.
Of course. Well, you've obviously reactivated your one of your first loves.
That's about it. You know, it's like going back,
and
it's fabulous. You know, I feel as good about my life and my career now in my painting, and I feel like I'm improving. You know, I feel that progressive and that improvement stage. And I don't feel like I've done the greatest painting in the world yet. I still want to live so I can do that good painting. And I'm getting the feedback by winning shows and selling.
Selling paintings.
I've got paintings all over the world. I just sold a big watercolor last year to a vice president of Volkswagen over in Germany.
Really?
He built a condominium over here on Longboat, bought one, and came into the gallery and bought the biggest watercolor I've ever done.
Now, here you are on the Gulf Coast of Florida, and living the good life, and you're not standing still. You're obviously... This is really sort of a second career for you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, what I say and what I feel is that, except for those momentary periods, like that period of being demoted and realizing that the career has stopped there, which are down periods, except for little periods like that, my life has been a totally satisfactory life. I've got five kids that are fairly normal, and you know, none of them have wound up in jail or in bad drugs or anything like that. And I'm really having as much fun now painting as I had when I was first in the design business.
Can you relate in a sort of a penultimate phase of your career, how painting came natural to you after a career in design?
Well, I find that when I do a painting, I design the painting. I approach the painting as a design problem, not only of looking at a scene, you know, and copying the scene, but I look at the scene and say, how can I make this scene look better? It's kind of it's a little bit phony, but I say, you know, I can move that tree, or I can move this beach, or that water over, you know, change the angle of the beach or the curve, or and I can make a very, well, I think all artists do this. I think that I am a little more aware of what I'm doing than some artists are. They sort of do it instinctively, but I think I'm probably a little more aware of it than a guy that has been trained as a fine artist instead of a designer. But like this painting here, I got an invitation from the design center they reinstated their art and hobby show.
In Pasadena?
No, at Styling.
Oh, Styling.
At Styling.
Oh, yes, of course.
And I got an invitation to participate.
When was that?
A couple of years ago.
Oh, good, after you'd retired.
Oh, yeah, several years after I'd retired. And so I did this painting and I submitted it and I won best of show. Best
really?
Of show, not best watercolor, but best of show in the four designs. I felt great about that.
Oh, marvelous. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
They've reinstituted their what again?
They used to have this art, Styling art and hobby show.
Okay.
Then there were, yeah, and they, when they had all those big cutbacks, they cut that out. For a while, and they've reinstituted that activity.
And you're winning first place. Was poetic justice you felt?
Well, I felt good because it's nice to go back with your peers and some of the younger guys, you know, and beat them out.
You remember some of those people that you beat out in that competition?
Well, you know, there was. Rodriguez, what's Rodriguez's first name? Fritz Mayhew.
Really?
And these are all top-notch artists. You know, they're not only top-notch designers, but also top-notch artists. Now, Rodriguez is a fine watercolor, and so is Fritz. And Gil Treewick. A couple other guys, but when I was proud of the painting. It was a good painting. I knew that going in. But when I won Best of Show,